So I would like to tell you that I'm Robert Jackson, but those of you on the medical staff know better. Robert is sick and asked me to introduce Steve this afternoon. The easiest place to begin is simply to say that Steve is a man for all seasons, but of course that can't be true or would have fall by now, and we certainly are nowhere close. Steve is a native of Hong Kong and took a Bachelor of Science in Electrical Engineering at the University of Western Australia, and worked in industry for a number of years, came to this country, took a PhD in computer science at Lehigh University, continued to do some industry stuff, went to Stanford in the early 90s after a postdoc in Japan, was on the faculty there for a number of years, and in about 2003 or 2004, moved to Brigham and Women's Hospital and to Harvard. And we attracted him last March to join us as Vice Chair of Radiology and as Director of Bioinformatics at the Research Institute. Simply to call him the Director of Bioinformatics doesn't do justice to his broad interests and incredibly diverse skills. I think, rather than go through his CV in detail, I think his title epitomizes many of his interests and many of his skills, and I think by way of introduction, or completing my introduction, I'll just read his title because I think it reflects his three major interests, linking bioinformatics and imaging for personalized medicine, and there you have it, bioinformatics, imaging, and personalized medicine. And so, Steve, rather than steal your thunder and tell them all the things you're going to tell them, I'm just going to turn it over to you.
Thank you very much, Mike. I don't have to stay here, so if you don't mind, I can walk around. Appreciate you guys coming in at 5 o'clock so late, and hopefully this will not disappoint you. This is the talk that get me excited to come to Methodist. It's a praise the opportunity to do something very new. And I will share somewhat our view here, and happy to be interactive with you and raise questions on that. When people talk about personalized medicine, first of all, come to the image. This cartoon from New York Times, New Yorkers actually say, give me the gene, go to the prescription, find something that fits my genes. And actually, this is sort of true, but not really true. By now, we know that, right? Because there's many factors involved in the personalized medicine besides the genetic factors. And if you look at the current practice of reactive medicine, pretty much what we are doing today is really in engineering, we call it try and error. Give this guy a drug, see what happens. If it's non-specific, non-selective, come back again, give another drug, see what happens. Finally, get something converged. And if, why the time is passing by selecting drug, the patient getting sicker and sicker. I mean, this is not an overstatement. This is just a general practice in a way. And the most ideal case in terms of medical care, really the optimum case, we really want is able to prescribe, everybody's dream, right? Prescribe the right treatment for the right person at the right time. In a way that, and in order to do that, you need the deposition screening, all the past from the genetics. The dream is if you can get the genetics right in the beginning when the person gets born and keep track of it and grow up the whole longitudinal record of all the information. And by the time you're doing the diagnosis, prognosis, you are not at that particular point. Actually, you're looking at the whole history of the patients. And then you can do you have a better chance to get a better drugs and monitoring. This whole idea, this ideal case. And we haven't got to that wonderful place yet, but we are getting there. We have a chance to get there. So I'd like to share with you some of the dream we are thinking about. Many definitions of personal medicine from the informatics point of view will be combining the clinical data with the advance in the molecular biology, genomic, proteomic, this time molecular screen, and all the information you add together, hopefully you get a pill that really solving the disease problem. This is a very overview. And some example, one of them would be the pharmacogenetics, right? This is one of the study is people start realize that different people, because of our genetic profile, may have adverse side effect to the drugs prescribed. And there were the choice of the drug efficacy, safety, dosage, and all these things were according to the profile of the drug. So as a patient of the high profile, you may prescribe a different strategy compared with moderate and low risk. Current way we're making drugs are blockbuster drug. We assume everybody collapse into a single point and then make the drugs trial accordingly. And the pharmacogenesis basically happily changing a little bit more personal in the way subtyping the population so you can optimize giving the drugs. And one example, right, Roche has come out with this chip, CYP450. And it's a famous case because people die of the taking the depression drug. Because of there are two particular CYP which is generate some sort of metabolite used in 25% in all diseases. And in this particular case, you were testing out in the traditional way, we do all standardized. You know, we don't care about the patient, just everybody's the same, cookie cutter, the same population. But if you go down to look at the genetic profile, in fact, in this particular case, they actually go according to the side effect. Some of them will be very high, very low to the metabolic of this particular CYP genes, and the other one will be less. So you have four different groups, and based on different group, you prescribe the dosage accordingly. And this is the one in the market right now. And another very famous example being charted as the first case of genomic success, right, is the HER2 receptor, which is, I think it's marketed. First, it was started 25% to 30% of breast cancer. It's very aggressive, you know, in the sense HER2 receptor case. Hepcidin is one of the monoclonal was discovered to able to pinpoint the HER2. The discovery was done in 1998, I believe, by Genentech. But the product, hepcidin, the molecular test, not come out until 2003, I think, something like that period. And so there's always time gap. But this is a perfect example on a triumph of a so-called a genomic advance turned into something that actually useful in the market and medical device. So positive test will respond to hepcidin, and negative test, you go to different directions. Despite all this, even if the HER2 case, they are not panacea, basically. And we know that for the HER2, is the patient not 100% response to the case also. And reality is, again, we prescribe the drug, the single bullet paradigm, which is not really true anymore. We know that. And the drug company also know that. And this is sorafenib. It's a very new, it's a one drug, actually right now it's phase 3 study already passed through for advanced renal carcinoma. And this drug actually, instead of looking for one single bullet target, they look at multiple bullets. They basically look at the VEGF and PDGFR. And it's blocking both angiogenesis. If you look at this pathway, this drug actually blocking both angiogenesis pathway and also the tumor growth area. So you are affecting the cell proliferation, adhesion, apoptosis, and survival, this part. So it's a one drug hitting multiple target drug. Now, that is okay. That's still doable in our human brain. And there's some psychology told me that, friend told me that you can only remember seven digits in your brain. That's the reason our phone number is only 7 digits. I guess there's a reason, correlation to it. So this is okay when we're dealing with a couple of drugs. The reality, life is not that difficult as always. We know that. The reality is there are many, the lab was all linking to each other. And the life when you scale it up from this genomic, all this area to finally to reach the network, is very complicated. They all intertwine to each other. When you brought one particular pathway, there's a way to go around it. So you need to do about a multiple target to do it. The problem is, if you look at this particular case, this is a very simple case of an East cell, okay? Just an East cell, you already by now we know 14,000 protein-protein interactions. And this is an issue that we are facing. That's why you need bioinformatics, because you reach a stage that looking at the data doesn't make any sense anymore. We need a computer approach, automated approach, able to model this functional pathway, able to identify what are the interaction, able to automatically tell us what are the possible hundreds of targets and how they interact each other and prioritize it. And that's why bioinformatics coming in making drugs. And nowadays, a lot of pharma companies actually changing their whole drug strategy for that. Eli Lilly is one typical case. It's a company basically completely revamping their manufacturing process. They're going for a personalized medicine approach in making drugs. Whether it will be successful in terms of making money, that's another question. But the company is bold enough to make it forward. And if you look at that, the challenge of this is really, if you're using this approach, is we have the basic science in the past 2 decades, because NIH is keep on throwing money in this area. The life science actually advanced a lot in terms of automation. It's a curse and blessing, depending on how you look at it. We suddenly have a lot of information, like genome. Right now we have whole genome, and the way we'll talk about 1,000 genome in the next 10 years. We have a lot of high-throughput device can able to generate genetics, proteomic, metabolize all this information automatically, just in a snapshot. The problem is this data, when it's generated, what do you do with it? Right? It's all piling up, no people know what to do with it. And you start, there's a reason you need a informatician come here or statistician come here to do data mining, modeling, how to interacting, creating a functional level, identify the components, and how to make it into a integration and predict the modeling and put a drug trial on it. The whole process is so complicated. The problem is, every time we go from one scale to another scale, from genetic to proteomic, for protein scale, we assume the relationship is linear. But by now, we know that it's not linear. So the complexity is tremendously increased, explode. This is a problem we are facing today's medicine. It's a good problem to solve, but no one is really solving it ethically. And the approach our department, King and I, were thinking about is, even for this approach is very complex, we're thinking about is we are taking a more pragmatic approach in a sense. We still do this functional genomic proteomic analysis, but this is a bottom-up biology, and we're taking a top-down imaging. And we once identify the biomarkers, we can degenerate contrast, or you can generate contrast agent. We're able to image the location, pinpoint the exact location of the tumor area. And then convert it. When you see it, there's no hiding. And if you're not quite sure, you can also do image biopsy, go inside, guided by image, to pick up the tissue, bad tissue and good tissue, and go come back and do functional genomic to verify your biomarker is correct or not. So this approach is sort of a combining a sort of top-down imaging with bottom-up biology. That's what the imaging and biology met. It's rather unusual. If you look at a lot of science and literature, paper, they all talk about bottom-up, all about a whole bunch of this thing, discover something, find some biomarker, and then stop there. What we want to do is something translational, useful in clinics. So we want to make a loop close and come up with something useful. And this is actually just come out from Scientific America about nanotechnology. An interesting thing about the grand challenge of the National Nanotechnology Initiative. They talk about 3 things, actually, all touched heavily with imaging. Of course, the first goal is to improve imaging, i.e. develop a new contrast agent able to image better. The other one is actually, this is about nanoparticle. Go inside the body. This is a nano shell example they're using. And using light to heat it up. So localized therapy, so phototherapy approached. And this can be done by neo-infrared light. And of course, you can do tissue engineering to better material using nanoparticles. But you can see the trend, all these things is linking together with imaging is the guide for everything. Once you're seeing things, you can start pinpoint the problem area and do something about it. And in our program, in terms of personal medicine and our radiology department, we focus on 3 areas right now. One is the bioinformatics, but integrated bioinformatics. We're not just doing one-off solution. Hopefully, we can create a database, an integrated database, integrated information, so knowledge is accumulating. The power database statistic. So the more you get into the database, the real data, the database is more truthful. And hopefully, you can do the longitudinal one, although we need to work with IT people more on this particular part. Rick is here. So this is very challenging about the next future of the medicine, because think about it. Right now, you have a lot of genomic, proteomic, all the science scoring, all the gene discovery, but they are not translated into the clinical side. One of the factors is really there is no infrastructure linking the two. Some people just look at the paper after a couple of years and look at it, it's interesting, let me try it on clinical. if you can have an integration of data, research data and clinical data together on your desktop, most likely the translation result much faster. The other part is the personal biomarkers. I will show you some example. And the last part is really using this biomarker to do you some sort of image-guided, we call diagnostic and therapy together. Basically, hopefully, able to see and treat the disease at the same time. Not bypassing pathology, but just to give you an example. So for bioinformatics, everybody knows that there's many different type of data type. You're building a data analysis and management. I want to just give you some example we have done in the past. So show you what do I mean. This is one case of the epilepsy surgical planning, which is, I think, Bob knows very well, the process. Basically, you have an MRI, EEG, and a patient history, identify the case, and you go for EEG telemetry for a while. If result is positive, you identify the loci area, you go into surgery or radiotherapy treatment. If it's not, you go to intracranial, i.e. open the scalp, stuck a couple of electrodes inside there, stay there for a couple of weeks and see what happens. Identify the loci area, right? And this has been quite established process on it. And this particular study, we actually including multimodality imaging, shoot different pairs, CT, throw everything in, see whether we can identify better without going through this intracranial telemetry, which is basically is another surgery. Before you do a surgery beforehand. So, and this study was done at UCSF when I was there. We created a integrated infrastructure, and basically you can get all this image data type and signal all on web. Basically, they can pull it out, and you can for this particular case, a co-registered ML and EEG as well as the patient video. And you can actually combine them. There's a software online you can actually play around different co-registration, fusion, all this information together. In this particular case, this patient actually was missed in the early round. We do the study. We basically using MEG identify the dipole and the mesotemporal lobe area and go back to co-register with the PET and then identify the hyperpolarization, hypometabolism in this particular left or right, depending which way you're looking at it, temporal lobe area, and then go back to seizure. This patient was going for surgery afterwards. So this type of online information allow the clinician actually sit down using a tool and start making the decision very quickly, the planning, instead of waiting for weeks to put the data together. And this is already been done. Another one is done at the breast cancer area. This is the ductal carcinoma in situ. And we take the breast MRI, which is still, at that time, still not very popular. Now it's become an established modality. And mammogram, basically, you do the biopsy, take a tissue, you do microarray studies. With this combination of information, you pass it into a risk assessment program to subtype categorizing the tumor staging and which stage they are in. From that, you really define a subtype of disease and their predisposition and hopefully really tailor the treatment. The whole idea of a personal medicine is really able to deliver the treatment strategy according to your own biology, not just cookie cutters, and which your own biology means that your combination of your genetic proteomic and other clinical imaging data. And this is only a snapshot. And the whole idea is, if you think about the whole informatics management, is really the concept is it's not an acute disease type of management. A lot of, I know surgery is a very acute disease oriented, but reality, long term, it's not. It should be life cycle oriented. Because in the case of women's health, and in early stages, age dominated and hormone replacement after menopause, if a disease dominated, if a lot of sort of disease coming out. But a lot of them look at it at this point. But if you can capture all these other key points, the hormone changing period, over the medical record, it will be much ideal in making it. So the whole idea is the medical record, the concept of medical records should be changed. You should capture the whole, I'm talking about a dream, just not now, but when a baby first born, you should start taking a genetics profiling, and which is 10 years from now is doable. George Church, a good friend of mine down at Harvard Medical School, is already working on a $1,000 genome, and some people talk about $100 genome. So When they get to that price, you can do a genome very easily, for a personal genome. And then you can do just like you come and do regular MRI screen. And you can capture it. And you can do a proteomic study in future, all these things. The question is where to put them together, where to put the database together is an issue. And there's a difference between the science moving very fast, the informatics, IT need to catch it up and utilize this information. So my concept of informatics is not a snapshot. You should look at the whole thing of the whole patient life cycle. And the other part on the personalized biomarker, which is the biomarker is covered at a stage in detecting the disease, staging it, prediction, determine. You all know that. And the trend is you will create a biomarker panels to identify multiple targets for treatment. And if you look at this particular case, this is a hub. You can model our pathway into this network, just like your internet network. There's no difference. The same mathematics actually apply to it today to analyze the cellular network. And you can understand, you can see some of the module. For this module to communicate the module, for a particular drug, for example, if I lock down this guy, right, some of the drug can lock down this guy. These two modules still can communicate because instead of going through this, I'm going through this route, another route, somehow going through it. So the idea is you need to have multiple targets hit at the same time. That's what I mean by you need a multiple target. And you need to time it too. And this is a challenging, how to do it. This is a different concept of putting drugs in the future based on your profiling. And the whole idea is really, the concept people arguing is the shift of paradigm is not symptom-based, it's based on the biomarker-based medical care. You identify the set of biomarker-related disease and then target those biomarkers strategically. And some of the biomarker set would be the future trend would be actually make it smaller and smaller, so small that you can carry it. Right now you go to a wet lab, it's a huge bench of things. But technology is moving very fast, especially in the area of nanoelectronics and nanotechnology. Very soon you can get it something very small, right? And then think about the computer today, from the mainframe IBM day to your desktop to your iPod, right? So in future, all these tests will be carried into a shrinking miniaturization, being a small thing, mobile device in the clinics. And something like Lido, all these things. And you can do a diagnostic marker set for the tissue serum or testing drugs or prognostic biomarker. And some of the projects we are working within our group right now collaborate with Singapore. The government apparently put a lot of money in this area, which is must well leverage it, I figured out. So this is one example on a little chip they are making on the real-time PCR. And this particular chip is they do all these blood serum example and their mixer here. And basically you can do the whole process of extraction, purification, amplification all in one small tiny chip. And this is how the chip size look like. This is a small one. And then the PCR chip compared to a penny, the size that they can get. And this is a 50,000 in this small area. You can see the size they can get, all this. So basically one study, you can do the whole genome study. And right now the second step would be how to package them into something small. Yeah. And some of the things about the cocktail drug screening, a lot of people talk about cocktail drug screening because our tumor is really depending on where it's according to our mutation, genetic mutation, all these things. So no, even with the same syndrome, same disease, may not using the same dosage of drug. One of the studies we're doing really a study of this called this the multi-scale type approach from cell to zebrafish to mice. You can't throw it on the human right away, so it'll do it on the cell study first. And the idea, the step is you construct a molecular pathway network involving multiple drugs first. And from there, you predict what the potential combination, what the best combination of a drug. And then you evaluate using this type of high throughput assay very quickly. You don't take years. This is you can do within days. And you can get a result quickly, and hopefully then you can give you some specific idea how to pick a better cocktail drug for humans. And some of the study I've been doing a lot is a drug screening, high content drug screening, which is another move beyond the high throughput screening in a pharmaceutical company, which I work with a lot of farmers. They're basically going for this direction. Basically, look at morphological change of the cell assay instead of signal, which is much more accurate. And we do a lot of drugs on Alzheimer's, neurodegeneration, and This is a nuclear translocation. You can do millions of drugs within 1 week. And all these things is very fast. Fully automated fluorescent microscope. You just hit a button. You have a 400 well. You can do 400 experiments. Each experiment is different condition. Hit a button, you go home. They can just fully automate imaging all the image condition. The problem is, of course, is an informatics problem, right? You create mountains of data. And that's why informatics become important in this angle. That's what all the people come to me later on solving this problem. Yeah. And this is another essay we do on the Alzheimer, which is the... This particular one is working together with Brett Hyman down in MGH. This is some live mice, actually. We implant a plaque inside the mice, and then we're imaging the behavior over time, over the given period, time of 21 months, 11 days, 18 days, 25 days, and try to understand the green one, all the neurons, the blue one, all the veins. So you want to understand what the neurotoxicity of the toxicity of the plaques we have, and also see whether it can be reversible. Well, after we remove the plaque, will the thing grow back, and which doses they will go back? This is an in vivo subway experiment we are doing. There's a more come to home in clinical. This is right there. This is a part probably King mentioned a little bit. We're working together. There's a project I get to work with him for a couple of years on this part, particular part with Cleveland Clinics. Basically, is we collect the serum, and then for the people, this is about 900 patients. Identify their proteomics screening, identify their markers. And for this marker, hopefully, the percentage, to identify the percentage whether this patient have a heart attack 6 months down the road. The one approved by FDA is in 2003. The kit approved by FDA is 55%. It's almost a thing about flipping a coin type of accuracy, right? But this particular one, our group has improved to 78% of the accuracy in pinpointing that this guy may have a heart attack 6 months down the road. But that's not good enough, of course, you know that. But the next step is this becomes a decision point to justify you go for more in-depth, definite, localized plaque imaging. Right? In the past, you cannot say, I screen everybody use this. It's impossible. That's very expensive. So the strategy, using a low-cost approach like serum blood test, to identify subtyping into high-risk populations, and then use imaging to pinpoint what's the problem area more definitely. A similar approach, this project with Stan's group, Pearl's group. John is here. And this project is the same idea. It's about post-ischemic stroke treatment patients. And right now it's about 10% of patients, what I understand, will be, when we put a blood thinner to them, they will probably die of it. But overall, the benefit is better for the other 50% will benefit. That's the reason the strategy is doing that. This study is basically subtyping, identify what that 10% will be adverse side effect of these blood thinner drugs. And what we do, we take a serum, and then we do imaging, and we're using called permeability MRI markers to identify the tissue viability. What are the tissue worth saving or not? And then combine these two information, and then assess the risk, identify which patient we should, who we should give the drug, who should not. Those are very pragmatic application. Those are not far out, and you can do it today. If people can get an IRB together faster, this can move faster. And some of the study we have done, this is image genetics of the identical twins together with this Paul Thompson, good friend of mine down at UCLA, on the identical twins populations. And this is about the cortical thickness. It's a population base. So the identical twins for schizophrenia patients, they are more similarity in terms of thickness area. But fraternity 50%, the ones sharing 50% genes, they don't. And of course, this you can do the longitudinal follow-up in quantitations, and this is done together with Taming Liu in our group and Jeff Young, one of the neuroradiologists, tracking the progression of the quantitate the tumor size automatically based on the drug treatment. And another study, this is a real MRI image. These are not rendering. So you take the real MRI, and then you can, using a certain techniques, to actually identify all the tractography, all the fiber tract. And this is important for surgery. If you identify, for planning of surgery, if you identify certain lesion in the way of the tract, you understand how you plan your things. And functional markers, of course, functional MRI, and this is a PET-CT image. They combine a lot of this information, now is modalities. In hardware-wise, they combine together already. In the past, they do a lot of software. Now you can get a PET-CT machine. You can identify the the anatomical area and also the metabolic in the area. And functional MRI in the same case. This is a study that done together was Martino Center. This is with Fenomai Ichise, done to Chief of Nuclear Medicine in Colombia. And this is another example of the markers, imaging markers, using perfusion. And this particular case is using different area. You can tell in terms of signal intensity, the tumor and the white matter is so hugely different. This study I worked together with at UCSF. So the idea, I'll just give you a very quick idea, is a lot of existing things, if you do a little bit more post-processing, you can get a lot of physiological information than just more than meet the eyes. Right now, we are not getting much value out of the existing data. And this is another cool study. I always love this study. Collaborator with Chris Walsh down in BI Deaconess. And this is it's about a neurodegenerative disease, a donor barrel. We checked the two family and then identify what's the imaging phenotype with this population. Right now, we still continue to study. We've only done one study. Basically, for this particular group of neurodegeneration patients, we find out they don't have a very clear central cell site. I don't know why. We will still find out. But this is an interesting finding for this particular group. The last one I want to quickly go through is the molecular imaging guide for therapy stuff. And this is the targeted probe. And basically, component of two parts. You have a targeted ligand attached to the molecular target, which is a tumor site. And then you can put a payload there. The payload can be a labeling with optical radio tracer or even a truck. That's how you do molecular imaging. And you using imaging to deliver imaging it. And all these benefits, people create, you can do detection, selection, drug selection, development, therapy monitoring. And quickly, you don't have to read all this. I'll just give you some example. There are 8 established way of develop targeted probes, depending on what sort of chemistry you are. You can be a receptor base, can be enzyme activity, or even some of colleagues down in children is a cell therapy approach or gene therapy approach. Of course, this is the one through the phosphorylation, go inside the body. This is the tradition of the PET image. FDG PET is based on this approach to go inside and light it up. So there are 8, they established approach already. And the question is how to make it reliable, work. And if you think about the target payroll, in a way it's almost like right now the drugs development is like this. You blind yourself, you shoot. Hopefully you shoot something, you get something done. The target payload through the molecular imaging approach is you really have a warhead, really, using whatever monochrome antibodies, hormone, whatever, pipe, hitting the molecular target. And then you carry the payload. At the end, can be toxin, can be agent, whatever. So you really have a localized approach to do a treatment. And this is why molecular imaging is interesting. Molecular imaging is not just for diagnostic. The significance of molecular imaging is really combining the diagnostic and therapy together in one place and able to localize and able to see it in action because everything transparent instead of guessing work. Right? And this is one example of monoclonal antibodies with the enzyme and with a prodrug through the normal digestion, when it reaches a certain point, the prodrug go to the enzyme, the warhead, the payload can be enzyme, and prodrug become drug, localized in that local area. And this is another study using a bistable monoclonal antibody and light up seeing by SPECT, the region. And this one study done by when King's groups were done in Stanford, alpha beta 3 markers on angiogenesis. You can see the PM post, light up and not light up, very clear, no argument, don't need statistic. You see it, you do something about it. And this is the one in the market which is not very clear. And this is, of course, it's an Alzheimer one, it's a Pittsburgh compound, very famous one. Right now it's a phase 2 trial already. Basically, it's a 11 carbon isotope using alpha beta molecular probes. And you can see this is the traditional PET FDG, and this is a control patient, this is AD patient. If you look carefully, you can see some difference, but the problem is not differentiated enough. But if you put a peaceful compound in, you can see the control is all cold. Hugely difference, right? So this is why you can push up forward in terms of diagnostic. Right now, there's no imaging way to have an early diagnosis of Alzheimer's. And this is a study done by Rebecca's group with MD Anderson on using optical imaging microscope to look at the oral cancer. And if you light it up, you can see the cyto infrastructure is a hugely different between cancer and not cancer. And the idea is this type of probe, you can, using imaging guided, go inside the body. And you can deliver drug or deliver contrast agent at the same time. And this is a famous picture done in Brigham. The double donut, we call it. It's an MRI cut into half. So you have two men here. The neurosurgeon here is do the surgery. And you have a 3D model of this thing very nicely, with the tumor area very nicely. The problem is, it's only very good in the first cut. Once you open the whole brain collapses. All these computational models become useless. And that's the reason you need in this particular case, the surgeon can do the operation, Peter Black can do the operation at the same time, he can imaging at the same time. And you can do a very fast imaging. The problem is, this type of thing is, it requires a very delicate room. All the instrumentation need to be tracked, the instrumentation, because you're under a very strong magnetic field. All the equipment is different. So the approach we are taking here at Methodist, at least, there must be a better way. Always think about there must be a better way. So the approach we are thinking of is this. We incorporate the new advance in the life science area, genomic, proteomic system, more smarter way. This is the knowledge we are getting. We need to harvest them. From there, we can identify the biomarkers, incorporate advanced molecular imaging to pinpointing the error area. And then the whole idea is we don't want the whole study actually done in a dedicated operating room. If we can make it the design good enough, it can actually could be done in a home or some other battlefield or some other area. No, there's no reason it has to be in a very expensive operating room to do operations. And the design will be modular, iterative, I show you. And that requires we build a very multidisciplinary team. You can look at the composition of our department, which is you can find all kind of people here. Even myself, I don't know where I'm here. So this is one example of the workflow in the future using this type of approach. Basically, you do a PO-op, either using MR or CT, give you a 3D model, right? And then from there, using to guide. This is the machine done at NIH. We are actually getting one in for Methodist, redesign the second generation. This is a first generation machine. It's still very bulky and not very modular. The generation we are building is, we want to just a normal CT, but they have a gantry. So the patient just take a picture and move it, the same gantry, then move it into other area and can do a small operation using EM tracking or ultrasound needle. But you don't need a big bulky machine there. So free up the machine for other purpose while you do operation. When you finish, you want to confirm it, you can also go to the gantry back, do a post-op scan. That's more pragmatic. And this is using 3D model to guide the needle or biopsy or operation. And then you can do the treatment plan. Once you can see it, you can do something about it. And the iterative model. And this is the approach we're thinking about it, and we will put one into a mini mighty soon. Hopefully, we once get it done with the contract. And the first cut will be, the first project we're doing, think about is the lung cancer area. And this particular case is on the peripheral lung cancer. And everybody right now know the news, the CT screening is not advisable because of a lot of false positive and a lot of unnecessary surgery. But doesn't mean that the thing we should give it up. It's still good. You can see some nodule. You just don't know whether there's a tumor or not, bad tissue or not. So in this particular study, we're still using CT to screen as usual. When it's bigger than 1.5 cm, we go to other therapy. Less than 1.5, we go through this system. And basically, in this particular case, we're using optical microendoscope to go inside, inject the glucose analog. And if it's light up, we know it's metabolic in that particular region. If it's not, then we go to the next lesion. If it's light up, then we can go for different surgery treatment locally without taking any tissue out. You go inside, you can do, for example, you can do a radio frequency ablation right there at the point, electric wire heat up the tissue. And we're also working with Rice folks on narrow shells. Basically, it's something we can... The nano shell is some sort of nanoparticle. You go inside the body, and they will leak out during the tumor area. And then you shine, as I said early on, one of the slides, you shine some near infrared light, and it absorbs the heat and burn out the local area. And it's more focused, doesn't cause that much damage. And this is the approach we are talking about. The whole thing is very modular. You can taking place depending on what your disease you have. And you put different strategy on the back end, how you want the evaluation. So this is the so-called the future pathway of personal medicine based on imaging and bioinformatics we're thinking about. The process is really using a gene assay risk factor predisposition to get some sort of prediction, and then using some sort of IVD to get some detection, using imaging to pinpoint the problematic area and personalize it according to your biology and do the treatment. And in the past, they will stop there. It's very hard. It takes a long time. Take a couple of months to see what's going on. The idea is you couple these two, imaging and this proteomic stuff, you actually track and verify in real time, a couple of days. So you have to see the progression. Your response time needs to be faster, right? So in real time, there's a loop in closely monitor. This is what we think about linking molecular diagnostic, molecular imaging towards the molecular therapy, all in one go, in one loop go. And this is not a dream. It's all doable if you look carefully. It's a matter of getting all the pieces, people work together to get it going. So this summary, I don't want to take too much of your time. I think I make a statement is, really, the time is right. I think, why now? You ask a question. I think the time is right to combining informatics and molecular imaging to deliver personal health care. Personal medicine, people talk for years. There's a lot of false start, all these things. But if you can see the technology I show you, when you combine them intelligently, the time is right to get it working. Really, you can start treatment and diagnosis according to your individual biology. And from the molecular imaging and bioinformatics point of view, I think if you put them together nicely, enhance ability to predict the lifetime risk of developing disease, direct the disease in a clinical case, diagnosis the disease at its molecular level, not just when it becomes too late, when the tumor is getting very huge, and treat the disease minimally invasively through the image-guided therapy and monitor the effective treatment. And this is the dream that we are doing, and this is our goal. And in the way it's why you're changing the procedure, the next phase of the medical care, by integrating this new, infusing this new technology systematically into the systems. So this cannot be done by myself. So these are some of my collaborators over the years. Still collaborating. So I'm not getting out. Science is no barrier, right? You can, after all, it's patient care. We collaborate with all the people. Thank you. So, any questions?